Live from New York, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null. Got my
mojo working, but just don't. Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. We're going to show you about Parkinson's disease and how it begins in the gut of many people. And then a fat sugar diet common in the United States causes bacterial changes that may relate to the loss of cognitive functioning. Dried pomegranate potentiates the anti-osteoporotic and anti-obesity activities in our body. We're also going to look at the Mediterranean diet can reduce memory loss by 24% in this study. And a mother's stress alters the baby's gut and brain through the vaginal microbiome, and a lot more on health and healing. Also today, we'll be taking a look at Obama's secret Trans-Pacific Partnership scheme will criminalize saving seeds. It'll push biotech patent monopolies. It's bad to the bone. Glyphosate, cancer cover-up. Control animals and studies also ate glyphosate-containing food. We'll expose that, the first in American media to do so today. Also today, an in-depth discussion of fascism in the United States by Professor Henry Giroux from Truthout. We're going to have 15 ways Bill Clinton's White House failed America and the world, the alternate staff. We're going to take a look at nuclear power station, cancer warning, breast cancer rates are 500% higher when you're downstream from a nuclear plant. Also today, researchers say aborted fetal cells in vaccines causing increase in autism. First, they denied that there were aborted fetal cells in vaccines. Now we've shown there are, and we use their science to prove it. Now we're showing what no one else is showing from the Journal of Public Health and Epidemiology's the danger of this. If time permits today, the American Medical Association prepares gag orders for medical dissenters. So if you're a holistic physician, you're in trouble. If the AMA isn't stopped, we intend to stop them. Major lawsuit. If they thought the last lawsuit that they got hit with and lost, clear up the Supreme Court, was bad, wait till you see what I've got planned coming at them. And by the way, we are working on lawsuits against Wikipedia and some, unfortunately, and it is unfortunate, a major non-commercial radio organization. But when people cannot apologize for being wrong, and when they keep doing the wrong thing and they're libeling people, they have to be held accountable. So we have a lot going on right now. Also today, from Prince EA, why I got rid of most of my friends, and after hearing this, you might want to do the same thing. 15 horrifying facts about processed meat. Fracking nightmare in Lancaster. We're going to play you the audio and let you know whatever happens when our politicians say yes to dirty energy. You'll hear the answer. As you see, we are packed to the gills with information. It's meant to empower. Sometimes it can be a little wake-up call, but more often than not, it's meant to inspire us. Let's begin. We have a lot of Americans with Parkinson's, but we have an epidemic of Parkinson's, Alzheimer's, and dementia coming from the baby boomers and their parents. According to University in Denmark, a major epidemiological registry-based study at the Aarhus University indicates that Parkinson's begins in the gastrointestinal tract. Now, that's important. So this chronic neurological Parkinson's disease affects an increasing number of people. However, scientists still do not know why some people develop Parkinson's, others don't. And they're now saying it's in the gut. I've heard a long time, pay attention to the gastrointestinal tract, and that it's spread through the vagus nerve to the brain. Quote, we have conducted a registry study of almost 15,000 patients who have had the vagus nerve in their stomach severed. Between approximately 1970 and 1995, this procedure was a very common method of ulcer treatment. If it really is correct that Parkinson's starts in the gut and spreads through the vagus nerve, then these patients should naturally be protected against developing Parkinson's disease. And that's how they open this. And, quote, our study shows that patients who have had the entire vagus nerve severed were protected against Parkinson's disease. Their risk was halved by almost after 20 years. So, and that was published in the peer-reviewed journal Annals of Neurology. So this, what does this really mean in lay language? It means that the brain creates the thoughts. And with that, there are physical, biochemical, hormone, reality in the body. But then your gut has its own brain and its own immune system. So when your one brain is telling another part of the body what to do, it will follow through. So if you're sad, if you're anxious, if you're depressed, if you're happy, if you're joyful, all that gets transmitted instantaneously into good or bad, constructive or destructive, healthy or unhealthy biochemical reactions in the body. If you're under stress, if you feel unappreciated, unloved, unwelcomed, then your body, the DNA is adversely affected and you start turning off healing and turning on diseasing. On the other hand, if you feel appreciated and you feel self-love and you're happy and you every day wake up with a positive disposition, then you're turning on a different biochemistry, and that biochemistry is very constructive. So if you have good gut health, if you're eating good foods, not the sugar and the meat, if you're eating living foods and juices and no sugars, then the brain, which has positive thoughts, the gut, which has a healthy biome, good bacteria, they work together synergistically. And by severing that vagus nerve, it kept the gut from being adversely affected as it otherwise would, and hence protecting the brain and vice versa. So that's what it means. A lot of people have very unhealthy guts. If you have an unhealthy gut, that can also impact your brain. Who would have known, right? There's also a good study. This was from Daegu Hanyi University, and it talked about dried pomegranate and how dried pomegranate, which is a good snack, by the way, it potentiates an anti-osteoporotic and anti-obesity activity. So one more reason to make sure that you get yourself some pomegranate. Fresh pomegranate is terrific. If you don't have that, then pomegranate powder, pomegranate concentrate, pomegranate juice, it's all good. University of Pennsylvania, a study that showed that stress during the first trimester of pregnancy alters the population of microbes living in the mother's vagina. Those changes are passed on to newborns during birth and are associated with differences in their gut microbiome as well as brain development. And that, and during a vaginal birth, a newborn is exposed to the mother's vaginal microbes and collectively known as the microbiota, which importantly colonizes the newborn's gut, helping its immune system mature and influencing its metabolism. And these effects take place during a critical window of brain development. So this was published in Endocrinology, and it just shows once again that if the mother, especially during pregnancy, is able to be on a de-stress program and healthy, then in the birthing process, you're creating a healthier gut and brain for your child. From McMaster's University, an interesting study on the Mediterranean diet. It shows that just the diet can reduce memory loss and thinking decline by 24%. That's huge. Previously prescribed to prevent heart disease and promote weight loss and prevent cancer and prevent diabetes, I've talked about it hundreds of times in the program. This is the first time that the diet high in olives and olive oil and grapes and vegetables and low on sugars and red meat would impact the brain. But this study shows that it does exactly that. And it's, if you've never been to the southern Mediterranean, mainly Greece and Italy, you really should go. The people are wonderful. The you could be driving along the coastline and suddenly hit a town that's 1,000 years old. And it's just, it's romantic, it's beautiful. I remember getting out of the car. I'm on a trip with my brothers, and we came to this place overlooking the Mediterranean. It was the middle of August, and it was just idyllic. So I had to get out of the car, walk up to a hay field, and just sit there. And I remember sitting there and hearing the clacking of the wheat with a warm August breeze looking out over the Mediterranean, and that was worth the trip. And you think, wow, how cool is that? How lucky are people who can live there and experience this all the time? So it's a slow talking, slow eating. Family is very important. Very few people are on any kind of psychiatric meds. They believe in resolving issues in the family. There's respect for elders. There's a whole lot of tradition that goes into the Mediterranean diet that's more than just the diet. But every single table I was at, and the people were more than generous. The Italians are so generous, so loving, so giving. And they always had grapes everywhere. Well, the Mediterranean diet is also really high in fiber, antioxidants, polyphenols, healthy fats from the omega-3 fatty acids, the monounsaturated fats like virgin olive oil, and more. And the dairy they have is not a processed dairy the way ours are, and they're not fed on genetically engineered corn. You'll see the dairy cattle out eating grass. Remember, hoof stock was designed by nature to eat grasses, to forage, not to eat grain and soybeans. That's also true for horses. And the best dessert you have there is something that comes from fruit. And beans and legumes and the flavors they use, the lentils and the chickpeas, they use hummus. And so you eat that type of diet, you're going to have memory longer. And this was published in the Journal of Neurology. So one more reason, if you can take a vacation and you can get over there, would be one of my favorite places, just to get off the route and go into the country and just to enjoy the population. One other thing you can do if you want to have a healthy pregnancy, according to Alexandria University in Egypt, is zinc supplements. This was researched at the High Institute of Public Health at Alexandria University and the Egyptian Ministry of Health. They looked at pregnant women, 20 to 45 years of age, and found that zinc, just 15 milligrams a day, that's not much, reduces pregnancy complications and newborn infections substantially. So this was published in the British Journal of Nutrition. And finally, this is from the Institute of Cardiometabolism and Nutrition in France, published in the peer-reviewed journal Gut, and talks about the microbiome changes may be a key to better metabolic health and obesity. In lay language, what they're saying is if you clean up your bacteria in your gut, that means getting rid of coffee, sugar, alcohol, refined carbohydrates, that's your pastas and your bagels and donuts and breads and buns, and you start eating healthier, you have healthier bacteria. And then if you eat sauerkraut or fermented foods, by the way, you can have fermented beets, and they're terrific also, and that helps you. And one other thing is it helps you, the more organic you eat, the more raw food you eat, the healthier, you're not going to be eating food dyes. And this study is an important study, and this was about food dyes damaging DNA structure and causing cancer. And so we sell over 15 million pounds of food colorings every year in the United States. And this is both unnecessary and harmful to human health. Simply put, these dyes are used to make food look prettier to consumers. In other words, it's purely a cosmetic thing to increase sales, but it's adversely affecting people. So Stay away from the food dyes. All right. I'm Gary Knoll. That's the latest on health and nutrition. Now, I want to share something from our environmental segment. This is about nuclear. I can remember going up to Connecticut, filming Knocking on the Devil's Door, and a woman named Miss Merrill, whose family is the Merrill Lynch family, she's a big consumer advocate, and she said that she had gone door to door on every block in her area and found that there was a very high level of breast cancer in women and their daughters who had no risk factors. They didn't smoke, they didn't drink, they weren't exposed to excessive sunlight. So why did they have all this breast cancer? And the only thing she could determine was because of how close they were to a nuclear power plant. But she couldn't get the officials to agree with her because they were receiving money from the nuclear industry. Well, we have made it very clear in several studies, and I did a study with a man who just died. He just passed. I think he was 94 years old. From the University of Pittsburgh, he was one of the leading medical doctor scientists in the world on the dangers of nuclear energy, Ernest Sternglass. And before him, there was Dr. Jay Gould, who had been with President Carter's Environmental Protection Agency. And together we wrote a couple of articles. One of the articles had to do with being downwind. No one paid attention to it. It was the right article, but at the wrong time. People just had other issues that they focused on. And it was just not high up on its list. That's all right, because someday they'll pay attention. It'll be the right time, and then you'll have that there. Well, now we have something new. This is from Liza Perry from Mail Online. Quote, women living downwind from nuclear power plants are 500% greater risk of developing breast cancer. Experts have warned in three separate studies. That's three separate studies. A team of scientists looked at the rates of various cancers in populations living close to these nuclear power stations. And they discovered breast cancer rates in particular were higher than expected and higher than the national averages at all three sites. And they were as high as 500% greater than average. And the research was supervised by Dr. Chris Busby, who has been on this program and was in our documentary. He's a great scientist. And the Latvian Academy of Sciences in Riga. So there you have it. Just one more reason why you should not be living near a nuclear power plant. Now, to the issue in California, and this is to help all the people out there who are wanting a freedom of choice, even if they're pro-vaccine. They may be pro-vaccine, but want to spread out the vaccines, not have all the vaccines. Like, there's no reason in the world to be giving polio vaccine, a smallpox vaccine, no reason in the world to give a citizen a hepatitis B vaccine if the mother doesn't have hepatitis, the child doesn't have hepatitis. So there's a lot of vaccines that you wouldn't give if you just were basing it upon good science and public health. But let's also say you want to delay not giving them all at once, but giving them over a 6, 7, 8 year period, even if that's for the pro-vaccine. And of course, the more research you do, the more likely you are to question the safety and efficacy of all vaccines, because when you do your research and see how much money goes into this and how much bad science comes out of it, you wonder why this has not been exposed before. So then we were told there's no aborted fetal cells in vaccines. That's just nonsense. Not true. They are there. And you can look at the CDC and then look at this. Now, we know that autism affects a lot of people, a lot of young boys in particular, and generally it affects them before the age of 3. And when you have autism spectrum disorder, it's not a single condition. It can be anywhere on a spectrum. You can become nonverbal. You can become unable to have social interactions or relationships. And you can have a very diminished interest in socializing or studying. Now, the autism rate in the United States is the highest in the world. And the places, let's say the advanced societies that have the lowest vaccine rate also have the lowest autism rate. Surely we cannot be indifferent to this. It's at about 1 in 50 young boys. And yet before we started max vaccination, it was 1 in 10,000. Now here is what Natural Health 365 says on this, quote, "The Environmental Protection Agency admits autism is on the rise. Interestingly, a study by the Environmental Protection Agency found that the autism rates have not just steadily increased, but rather experienced dramatic surges during certain years over the past two decades. And though the EPA researchers fail to speculate exactly what may have caused those skyrocketing numbers, they do suggest that an external factor may be responsible for the rise in autism rates during certain pivotal years. However, it cannot be denied that changes in autism rates are directly correlated to pharmaceutical toxins within U.S. vaccines." And then it goes through what's in the vaccines, and quote, "From the Journal of Public Health and Epidemiology found an association between autism disorders and the use of aborted human fetal cells in the manufacture of certain vaccines." So there is another now in that coffin of those who are in the truth denialist. We have a lot of truth denialists in our society. Those who say that we don't use aborted fetal cells, we do. Those who say there's no problem, then they're not reading the Journal of Public Health and Epidemiology. And since 1979, when human fetal tissue was first approved for use in vaccines, the rates of autisms have markedly increased, particularly during certain years when major changes were made to the U.S. vaccine schedules. Now, aborted fetal cells introduces the DNA of an aborted baby into the body of a child. The results can be catastrophic, potentially causing a breakdown in the DNA, genetic mutations, even triggering an autoimmune response. And many children diagnosed with autism do not have symptoms present at an early age, but rather experience a sudden onset of symptoms that cause an unexplainable loss of learning skills, known as regressive autism. And this condition is associated with hundreds of DNA breaks and gene mutations, indicating it cannot be a congenital disorder, one they were born with, but rather a condition caused by external factors. So I believe that all parents, every single parent, deserves to know about vaccine dangers and how those made with aborted human fetal tissues may be a major cause of autism. And unfortunately, most will not receive this information because their medically trained doctors will instead make some kind of disparaging comment or criticism and say vaccines are safe and effective. But this audience knows differently. And to help you, what I have done is the following. Yesterday, we put over 50 articles, all fully referenced, full scholarship on a wide variety of topics, but over 36 of them on the subject of vaccines alone. So if you want to get, and it's free, it's there as a public service. So if you want to really educate yourself on the topic of vaccines, then go to prn.fm or progressiveradionetwork.com. If you forget that, GaryNall.com. All those will take you there, plus on my Facebook page, and you can read for yourself. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to take on some of these other major issues that are not being addressed out there. Please stay with us. All over the world, we have people listening. Nice to have you with us. We're going to take a few minutes, these are all short, and listen to a fracking nightmare in one area and what happens when our politicians receive money from dirty energy companies. You'll hear the answer right now.
We've got some of the best agricultural land in the whole of West Lancashire.
Our land is our lifeblood.
It's a lovely place to live.
However, 15 months ago, Quadrilla entered our lives and said that they want to put a frack site within 230 metres of people's homes.
Whatever's decided here will affect the rest of this country.
We know that this can be done safely and securely and in an environmentally responsible way, and we will do that.
That's exactly what the energy companies promised us in Australia too. But that's not what they delivered. They delivered destroyed land. They've left us with a toxic chemical nightmare. And that is what the industry brings to you. They came in, they took our land, they took our lives, and they destroyed our communities.
I'm on the front lines here in America. Most of us are on water wells. And now we have 10 townships that have families with contaminated water because of nearby gas drilling.
There was no one there to clarify and actually do an investigation to find out why the kids up the road, why their noses were bleeding all the time, why the woman up the road had rashes, why people's dogs started dying. We didn't know it was the gas making us sick, but what I do know is that we weren't sick before they came.
Quadrilla are proposing to drill 4 exploratory wells for shale gas here.
The radiuses that have been quoted in scientific studies suggest that anything within a 5-mile radius will be affected by the air particles.
The licence that Quadrilla have to operate will cover over 80% of the Fylde coast. And that basically means that you could have these well sites popping up everywhere.
What happens 10 years down the line? Quadrilla will have got the gas, the government will have the money, and we'll be left without anyone doing anything about it.
A leaflet which Quadrilla issued says, "Fracking is safe." How the hell does he know? They don't know. Nobody knows. And they are prepared to risk our lives finding out.
Everywhere you look, communities are saying, stop it before it starts. Don't let it go ahead. Learn from what we've learned.
Not only have they fractured the land, they fractured the community.
Please, from someone who's lived it, I'm warning you, get up, stand up now. Stop it.
We're guinea pigs for an experiment which we don't want to be part of.
We're just residents, and I'm just a mum, and I'm fracked to death.
How many times must we be lied to by corporations or the government agencies that are in support of those corporations? The other day you heard, or yesterday you heard, the remarkable final words of George Orwell. And a few weeks ago, you heard the last interview of Aldous Huxley, two of the most profound thinkers of the last century. What this means is today, when we have major fracking and oil-producing derricks in California, they're not being restricted in their water use. And yet a small farmer is and will probably go out of business because they cannot afford to dig deep enough to get the water up. You'll find that many of us will think that the only two possibilities for the next president will be either Clinton or Bush, because there's massive amounts of money from the same people counting that one of them is going to get elected, and hence their interests are served, and that would be Wall Street. Wall Street loves them both. They love dynasties because they can control them. When you give someone a $400,000 to do a 45-minute lecture about nothing, that means that that's payback. After all, wouldn't you give someone $1,000 if you got $1 million in return? And that's how it works in politics. But more important is that woman you just heard suggesting that she's afraid. She's just a mom. What does she know? Well, I believe that mothers know an awful lot, and joined together can be extraordinarily powerful. What we have not looked at and should have is the growing Orwellian partnership between the militarized state and private security companies in the United States. When I was last in Washington, D.C. to do a lecture for our sister station, WPFW, it was at a civic center, and it was huge. And I remember going in about an hour early, and I'm looking around thinking, whoa, they have like 5 screens on this, going down a whole huge wall because it was so big. And I'm thinking, they're not going to fill this. Well, they not only filled it, but they had people standing. Why? Because people wanted to know about insights that could help them live a longer life and a healthier life, but also a lot of people there work for government agencies. I asked, How many of you work for different bureaucracies? Like 80% of the hands went up. How many have important positions or know things that the American public would be angry if they knew about? All these hands went up. And afterwards, a gentleman came over to me, and he said, I can't tell you my name or which agency I'm associated with at this moment, but I'll tell you this. Your comments about how corrupt the city is, what did you call it, a giant toilet bowl overflowing that someone should pull the plug on. He said, you couldn't be any more right. Here's how it works. And he said, this is from my own personal experience. You end up getting a position as a person within a legislator's office, and you work your way up to where you're chief of staff or a head of media. All you do all day long is meet with donors, major corporate policy lobbyists who will give you bills that they expect to have your legislator implement. And then they give you the quid pro quo, enormous amounts of money. We'll raise you X amount for your campaign. But that's not what it's about. What it's about is that person who is there knows that they can leave there and go to work inside of a major corporation. And let's just say that you do all this not over the computer because they don't want a paper trail. They want plausible deniability. And they'll say to you, let's play handball 3 days a week at 5 o'clock in the morning where there's no surveillance. And we don't have to sign in, sign out, and pay cash. And they do. And that's where they make this man said he made the deals. And the deal is you swing legislation towards this defense contractor and in a no-bid contract, and you can leave this job in a year, come to work for us. You'll start at $500,000 to $700,000. You make $100,000 now. Plus, you'll get a Black American Express card. You'll get to lease any car you want. You'll get to use our corporate jet. You'll get to use our corporate retreats. You'll be able to fly around the world, et cetera, et cetera. And within 2 or 3 years, you'll be making $1, $2 million a year. And you'll have private memberships in all the best clubs. That's the payback. Now multiply that times 400,000 to 500,000 people in Washington every year who are made offers. And then you end up having a huge private sector militarized corporate entities. That's where they get all their admirals, their generals. They go out of the armed services and they go right into these corporations, sit on boards. And the perks are astronomical, all to influence policymakers. That's how it actually works. So when they're taking our tax dollars and spending it, our tax dollars, because the rich don't pay taxes, and major corporations rarely pay taxes. That's why I've advocated for a flat tax that everybody would have to pay, let's say like 17 to 20%. If every corporation had to pay it, you could abolish the IRS, you could get an extra $3 trillion annually in income coming in, and it would be fair. And you could also should abolish the personal income tax and put sales taxes, with graduating from very low for items we all need to luxury items very high. But there are people who profit from not having it that way. In any case, what we have is we have control over our lives without realizing it by these Orwellian partnerships, especially in the banking, the big agri cartels, in the pharmaceutical cartels, and that also includes the entire corporatization and privatization of our healthcare system, especially with this completely corrupt Obama system. So each day, new evidence surfaces pointing to the emergence of a police state that has produced ever more sophisticated methods of surveillance in order to enforce the mass supervision of the most essential tools of a democratic dissent. So if we want to challenge any part of the corruption of our current system of government or corporate interest, we become a target. And as a result, every activist, every civil rights advocate, every environmentalist, anyone with a conscientious perspective, any whistleblower on corporate malfeasance and government abuse, you become the enemy. And they are completely indifferent. By claiming that anyone who questions authority or engages in undesired political speech is a potential terrorist threat, our government is a corporate partnership that makes mockery of all civil liberties. Nowhere is this more evident than in American public schools, where a youth is sent there to be taught that they are a generation of suspects, subject to the presence of armed police and security guards, drug-sniffing dogs, and an array of surveillance apparatuses that chart their every move, not to mention, in some cases, how they respond emotionally to certain practices. Whistleblowers are not only punished by the government, their lives are also turned upside down in the process by private surveillance agencies and major corporations who now work in tandem. For instance, the Bank of America assembled 20 bank officials and retained the law firm of Hunton and Williams in order to advise a scheme where they would attack WikiLeaks and Glenn Greenwald, whom they thought were about to release damaging information about the bank. It is worth repeating that Orwell's vision of surveillance in the totalitarian state look mild next to the emergence of a corporate private state surveillance system that wants to tap into every conceivable mode of communication, collect every piece of metadata to be stored in vast intelligence storage sites around the country, and use that data to repress any vestige of dissent. Now, as Huxley anticipated, any critical analysis must move beyond documenting abuses of power to how addressing contemporary neoliberal modern thinking has created a social order in which individuals become complicit with authoritarianism. For example, go to almost every Ivy League school in the United States, and you'll find that the vast majority of graduates are determined to become a part of this authoritarian system, providing that they are rewarded. That is how we are not educating, but we are indoctrinating in how it's being internalized. What and how do state corporate-controlled institutions, cultural apparatuses, social relations, and policies contribute to making a society plunge into dark times, self-generated, as Huxley predicted? Put differently, what is the educative nature of a repressive policy, and how does it function to secure the consent of the American public? And most importantly, how can it be challenged and under what circumstances, aided by a public power structure and produced and circulated through a machinery of consumption and public relations tactics? A group regime of repression works through the homogenization of forces of the market to support the widespread embrace of authoritarian culture and police state, including publications that will, on one hand, challenge, and rightly so, and to their credit, racist policies of different individuals or bad corporate interest, but turn right around as Mother Jones in The Nation magazine and all the people on MSNBC who were commenting on it, and support fully vaccination without even one speck of introspection, as if they knew what they were talking about. And clearly they do not. Relentlessly entertained by spectacles, people become not only numb to violence and cruelty, but begin to identify with an authoritarian worldview. It was David Graeber who said that the police become the almost obsessive objects of imaginative identification in popular culture, watching movies or viewing TV shows that invite them to look at the world from a police point of view. But it is not just the spectacle of violence that ushers individuals into a world in which brutality becomes a primary force of mediating relations as well as the ultimate source of pleasure. There's also the production of an unchecked notion of individualism that both dissolves social bonds and removes any viable notion of agency from the landscape of social responsibility and ethical consideration. Absorbed in privatized orbits of consumption, commodification, and display, Americans vicariously participate in the toxic pleasures of the authoritarian state. Violence has become the organizing force of a society driven by a totally toxic notion of privatization in which it becomes difficult for ideas to be lifted into the public realm. Even on the left, ask anyone on the left, what is the most single important and valuable asset that was privatized and see if any dare name it. And it is not. It is impossible to get someone to talk about the privatization of an asset for personal gain. That is how indoctrinated people, even supposedly on the left, have become. And yet that privatization occurred. And with it, destruction on a massive scale. But that is the crime against those who fought for so long, that have a higher standard, and they were the victims. Under such circumstances, politics is eviscerated because it now supports a market-driven view of society that has turned its back on the idea that social values, public trust, and communal relations are fundamental to a democratic society. It is all about the individual, what they can control, the power they can use, and how they can demonize, ostracize, criticize, and ridicule anyone, even in their own group, who they're displeased with. And we have seen this repeatedly. This violence against the social mimics not just the death of a radical imagination, but also a notion of banality made famous by Hannah Arendt, who argued that at the root of totalitarianism was a kind of thoughtlessness, an inability to think, and a type of outrageous indifference in which, what did she say? There is simply the reluctance ever to imagine what the other person is experiencing. So when you're being condemned, when you're being libeled, when you're being slandered, when you're not given an opportunity to respond, when people are cowards and afraid to debate, but they have the platform, they have the body politic, they have the control of institutions and airwaves, then it's very easy to care not what the person you're attacking is experiencing because it's not you. By integrating insights drawn from both Huxley and Orwell, it becomes necessary for any viable, critical analysis to take a long view, contextualizing the contemporary moment as a new historical conjuncture in which political rule has been replaced by corporate sovereignty. And corporate does not mean just making a profit. Corporate could be nonprofit, nonprofit radio stations, nonprofit NGOs that have exploited every crisis in the Western Hemisphere. If you doubt me, go down to Haiti. Look at the Land Rovers. Look at the suites in the multi-million-dollar hotels where NGOs stay. Now look at the plight of the people they were supposed to be helping. What a farce. What a tragedy. What a fraud. Look at the walks for AIDS cure. Look at the walks for breast cancer. Look at all the fundraisers. We're very good at raising funds, but we never ask, where does the money go and does it actually make a difference? If we did, we would stop rewarding people for failure. Precarity has replaced social protections provided by the state. Just as the state cares more about building prisons and infantilizing the American public than it does about providing all of its citizens with quality educational institutions and health care. If we were at all humane and had any vestige of common sense, we'd have universal health care. And we would let everyone out of prison that was ever put there because they used drugs. America's not just dancing into oblivion, as Huxley suggested. It's also being pushed into the dark recesses of an authoritarian state. And I guess if you live on the Upper West Side, if you never venture into the heartland of America, if you've never seen what it's like to have your door knocked down and a whole group of armed to the hilt SWAT team raid you, if you're not present when a 96-year-old man in bed is shot in the chest with a shotgun from the police department in Chicago, and yet they choose not to indict that police officer, when you have a person a day being killed who's unarmed in America by police and you militarize the police, when you're subjugating people to stop and searches because of their ethnicity and their garments, if you're not aware of this, then I have a problem. There's no cure for stupid. And stupid is everywhere today in America. America's not just what it wants the world to be. Orwell wrote dystopian novels, but he believed that the sheer goodness of human nature would in the end be enough for individuals to develop modes of collective resistance he could only imagine in the midst of the haunting specter of totalitarianism. Huxley was more indebted to Kafka's notion of destabilization, despair, and hopelessness. For Huxley, the subject had lost his or her sense of agency and had become the product of a scientifically manufactured form of idiocy and conformity. Oh, if he were here today, what would he think of our reality shows? As Theodore Adorno has pointed out, where Huxley fails is that he has no sense of resistance. According to Adorno, the weakness of Huxley's entire conception is that it makes all its concepts relentlessly dynamic, but nevertheless arms them against the tendency to turn into their own opposites. Hence, the forces of resistance are not simply underestimated, but rendered impotent. The authoritarian nature of the corporate state surveillance apparatus and the security system, with its urge to surveil, eavesdrop, and spy on, and monitor, and record, and save every communication of any sort on the planet, can only be fully understood when it is ubiquitous, with its tentacles connected to wider culture of control and punishment, including security patrol quarters of public schools, the rise in supermax prisons, the hyper-militarization of local police forces, the justification of secret prisons, and state-sanctioned torture abroad, and the increasing labeling of dissent as an act of terrorism in the United States. This is a part of Orwell's narrative which it does not go far enough. The new authoritarian corporate-driven state deploys more subtle tactics to depoliticize public memory and promote the militarization of everyday life. Alongside efforts to defund public and higher education and to attack the welfare state, a wide-ranging assault is being waged across the culture on all spheres that encourage the public to hold power accountable. If these public institutions are destroyed, there will be few sites left in which to nurture the critical formative cultures capable of educating people to the challenge of injustices plaguing the United States and the forces that reproduce them. One particular challenge comes from the success of neoliberal tyranny to dissolve those social bonds that entail a sense of responsibility towards others and form the basis of political consciousness. Under the new authoritarian state, perhaps the gravest threat one faces is not simply being subject to the dictates of what Quentin Skinner calls arbitrary power, but failing to respond with outrage when my liberty is also being violated, and not merely by the fact that someone is reading my emails, but also the fact that someone has the power to do so as they choose. The situation is dire when people no longer seem interested in contesting such power. It is precisely the poisonous spread of a broad culture of political indifference that puts at risk the fundamental principles of justice and freedom which lie at the heart of a robust democracy. The democratic imagination has been transformed into a data machine that marshals its inhabitants into the neoliberal dream world of babbling consumers and armies of exploitive labor whose ultimate goal is to accumulate capital and initiate individuals into the brave new surveillance punishing state that merges Orwell's Big Brother with Huxley's mind-altering Soma. Nothing will change unless people begin to take seriously the subjective and underpinnings of oppression in the United States and what it might require to make such issues meaningful in order for them to take them as transformative. Now, for those on the corporate agenda, the Democrats, so you want to vote for Hillary Clinton. Why? Because you're enamored with Bill? Well, AlterNet staff did some homework, and Bill Clinton remains one of America's most popular presidents. In fact, a national poll by NBC and Wall Street Journal found 56% of Americans had a clearly favorable view of Clinton, and that's long been true for African Americans, from novelist Toni Morrison's famously calling him the first black president while in office to books explaining his appeal after his presidency ended. Clinton used his popularity to build an enormously ambitious global foundation. He collected $2 billion in assets, and he built a personal fortune into the hundreds of millions of dollars, made $30 million just from his speeches in recent years. So let's take an honest look at him. Then ask yourself, you still want to carry on this love affair with him and his wife? First and foremost, Bill loved prisons. In May, on the heels of the unrest in Baltimore sparked by Freddie Gray's death and police custody, Clinton apologized for locking too many people up. Thanks, Bill. You mean 2.4 million people today in prison and 160,000 Americans serving life in prison, largely because of your policies? Yeah. Tag-teaming with ex-President Ronald Reagan, Clinton is the president most responsible for the mass incarceration of Americans on an epic scale. His gun-ho crime-fighting in chief passed the single most damaging law with his omnibus federal crime bill of 1994, which included the infamous three strikes law and ensured that mandatory minimum sentences imprisoned even low-level, nonviolent offenders for a long, long time. So, what did Bill Clinton say about it? Quote on CNN with Christiana Amanpour. The problem is the way it was written and implemented is we cast too wide a net and we had too many people in prison, and we wound up putting so many people in prison that there wasn't enough money left to educate them, train them, and get new jobs. Well, that's the problem. How about your war on drugs, Bill? Oh, I forgot you did drugs. Then why didn't you put yourself in prison? In fact, why didn't all the former presidents put themselves in prison who did drugs? We don't hold people in power accountable. So just remember, Clinton's violent crime control and Law Enforcement Act in 1994, that set the nation on a path, and dozens of states followed with their own mandatory minimum laws. So how about all the people in prison since then? What, over 14 million? Then your punitive welfare reform. The consequences of Bill Clinton's welfare reform bill have been devastating for millions of American families. The Personal Responsibility and Work Opportunity Reconciliation Act of 1996 took a page directly from Republican Speaker of the House Newt Gingrich's Contract for America. In an atmosphere steeped in decades of conservative scaremongering around the specter of sexual recklessness, welfare queens, remember that? Clinton's 1992 campaign promised to end welfare as we know. Well, he did. And an awful lot of people suffered because of it. No one's asked him to apologize for that. Wall Street deregulation in chief. No president in American history did more to put money into the hands of Wall Street criminals than Clinton. Clinton outdid the GOP when it came to unleashing Wall Street's worst instincts by supporting and signing into law more financial deregulation legislation than any other president. That's according to the Columbia Journalism Review. He didn't just push the Democrats controlling the House to pass a bill, the Graham-Leach-Bliley Act, that dissolved the Depression-era Glass-Steagall Law, which barred investment banks from commercial banking activities. He deregulated the risky derivative market, the Commodity Future Modernization Act, gutted state regulation of banks, the Regal-Neal Act, leading to a wave of bank mergers, and reappointed Alan Greenspan as federal chair. So if there's one human being that caused more destruction, it is him. He gutted the manufacturing via trade agreements. He helped gut America's manufacturing base by promoting and passing the North American Trade Agreement, NAFTA. And in 1993, when Democratic-controlled Congress, is when he struck. And that resonates today because his wife is a big supporter of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which I mentioned yesterday. He also, there was no LGBT equality in the Defense of Marriage Act. The Defense of Marriage Act was one of the conservatives' biggest victories in the 1990s, passed by Congress and signed into law by, you guessed it, Bill Clinton. He defined himself as heterosexual and deprived legally wed same-sex couples of many significant benefits, from Social Security benefits to hospital visitation rights. Then he expanded the war on drugs. No president did as much to get as many people involved in drug war as he did. And look at the consequence of that. He expanded the death penalty. That's correct. That's when he was showing the world as Arkansas governor. He allowed the state to execute Ricky Ray Rector. Never heard of him? He was a convicted murderer with severe mental impairments. And when he was taken to his prison cell, from his prison cell to be executed, he wanted to save his dessert for later. That's how impaired he was. Clinton also returned to Cold War priorities, and with Jocelyn Elders and the culture war, and so he turned the Lincoln bedroom into a fundraising condo, and he bombed the Sudanese pharmaceutical plant August 20th, 1998. And of course, he doubled down on the Iraq sanctions. So those are just some of the things that Bill Clinton did, and you could expect even more from his wife. So, and he said he knew nothing about the coming Rwanda genocide. We know that was a lie. And he escalated America's foreign drug wars. I'm Gary Knoll. We try to share the information that others won't to help you get a better perspective of the people who are out there in our world today claiming that they're the experts. They know best and we should trust them. Have a nice day, everyone.